This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
As far as human flourishing, and I think we'll find it very, very
Sally Canning, Wheaton College, Associate Professor of Psychology.
It's such an honor to be here. I want to thank George for including me, Dr. Nancy, for including me in this track, and I wish we had enough time for me to go around and find out what each of you, what your disciplines are. I understand we have quite a mix in the room. Any psychologists in the room? Okay. And how about, I understand we have some social work. Is that right? I know we have sociology and anthropology. What, can you just throw out some other disciplines that we have in the room?
Political science.
Political science?
Okay. History.
History. Economics.
Business.
Okay.
Urban
and
studies.
I'm sorry?
Urban studies.
Urban studies.
Public health.
Public health. Excellent.
Education.
Education.
Linguistics.
Folklore. Wow. Let's give ourselves a hand. I think we have a small university. I think after Bob's talk, maybe we're ready to start our own semester. And how many people are currently in academic positions? Okay, and how many people, keep your hands up. You know what, stand up if you are in an academic position, would you? After we just asked this, okay. So these are professors, and now stand up if that's what you hope your future includes. Keep standing, those of you who are in still. Okay. Oh, so there's other things in life? What about the people who are sitting down home to do? Okay, thank you. You sit down. Well, I'm hoping that this talk will be relevant for all of you in the room. We have an amazingly eclectic group. I am a clinical psychologist. I'm a licensed psychologist. I'm a professional psychologist. That means I actually talk to human beings. I got my degree at the University of Pennsylvania, and there were two sets of psychologists there, and I'll just tell you, the other people said that they didn't interact with humans. And they shunned us because we did. They interacted with rats, which we thought was fine, but they did not think it was fine that we focused our time on human beings. But I'm also a community psychologist, which has a lot of implications for the way I think about psychology and about human beings and about how we think about behavior and what makes people tick. And I won't go into all of that, but I did get my degree at a secular university, so all my training was there. But I had two professors as very important mentors of mine, Dr. John Fantuzzo and Dr. Howard Stevenson. Oh, somebody knows? Yeah? How do you know John?
Oh,
church. No way! Are you from Philadelphia?
Well,
you
know him as well. We
were both at UF. Oh, wonderful. Okay, talk to me later. Okay, we'll tell John Fantuzzo's stories. Right. Yeah. The man runs on coffee and caffeine and all sorts. But both Dr. Howard Stevenson and Dr. John Fantuzzo were mentors of mine, both believers and examples of the kind of work in psychology that Dr. Priest was talking about. So that's just a little bit about me. My entrance into psychology was circuitous. I was a music major and a vocal performance major, and the process of taking voice lessons and teaching them is very, very similar to going through and taking therapy, psychotherapy, let me tell you. To take a lot of risks, make a lot of ugly sounds in front of people, and hopefully grow and change through the process. I am also, consider myself also a scientist or someone who does scholarship, and that's an important part of my work at Wheaton. And a huge part of any Wheaton professor's role is teaching. We love our students, and it's any of us who teach at Wheaton know that that's the mentoring and education of our students is a huge aspect of what we do. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm really thinking of myself both as someone who is a helping professional. I spend a day a week in a clinic in a medically underserved area of Chicago called the Lawndale Christian Health Center. Maybe some of you are familiar with Lawndale's amazing work. And I do behavioral health consultation there with Latino and African American women and children mainly, because I work in pediatrics and OB. And my area of focus there is we're trying to screen and help to prevent and treat pregnancy and postpartum mood disorders. So I'm a practitioner, I am a scholar, and someone who is trying to help educate, you know, the next generation of Christian psychologists along with my colleagues. And so in all of those roles, the question of what human flourishing is and can it be fostered or what things erode it, and then for helping professionals in particular, or really anyone who teaches, I think, anyone who serves, the whole question of, wow, how do you not burn out in the process? How do we flourish as people who teach and serve and help? And should we be involved in preventing ourselves from burning out, or to what degree? These are questions that I feel that I have had to wrestle with over the 14 years that I've been a practicing psychologist and an academic, as well as I've become increasingly concerned about what little is out there written by believers, written by people of faith of any kind, or evangelical Christians in particular, about what we ought to tell ourselves in this area as we're training students to become helping professionals, and as we're turning people out to become instructors in universities. What do we tell them about how they're supposed to serve in ways that are distinctly Christian? So I sort of have three different questions that I considered as I thought about this talk. The first is just what can psychology and the Bible tell us about what human flourishing is? Our discipline thinks a lot about those kinds of questions. Second is, how is human flourishing promoted? And then this is the kind of research, one of the pieces of research that I'm working on with a group of students right now, and that I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on today, is how involved the Christian social scientists in particular be in the promotion of human flourishing. So I'm not sure what you'll be most interested in talking about, so I'll kind of try to blast through a lot of this and we'll talk about what you're interested in. Well, my discipline, psychology, we're known for sort of focusing on the negative. It all started with moms who were responsible for everything bad, and we've gotten over that a little bit, but clinical psychology is noted for its focus on disease, or what would be considered languishing. And community psychology, the area that I also identify very strongly with, has helped, and in public health and other areas, has really helped us to get our attentions much more broadly focused. So not only can we talk about and delineate in fine degrees what diseases are, you know, what is a bipolar 1 versus a bipolar 2 illness, we also want to be able to think about health and wellness. And so I've sort of constructed a little categories here of what psychologists have mainly talked about is really disease. And even in medicine, when people first started to try to talk about health and wellness, you had these kind of negative definitions where you didn't know what to say too much beyond it's just the absence of disease. But any of you who have you ever been really, really sick? I traveled one time and I got a really nasty bug, and I thought Bill Cosby was my doctor in my room, and I kept asking him to sign the forms. My mother tells me I was delirious. And I lost tons of weight, and when I got better after that trip, I never knew what it felt like to just not be sick. Have you ever felt to be like the day you're getting better after being really sick? Isn't it amazing? You start noticing my toes feel really great. You know, like nothing is aching in areas of your body that you don't even notice. And so we started to grapple as a discipline and in other disciplines with what really are we talking about when we're talking about people who are healthy and well. And then concepts of resilience and the whole idea of even beyond just sort of baseline health, what does it mean to flourish? Much less attention on those things, but people have really started to try to grapple with what those things mean. I like Emory Cowan, one of the fathers of community psychology's definition of wellness, which is really the concept that a lot of psychologists have thought about, maybe a little bit more than the notion of flourishing. And he breaks down the characteristics of wellness in sort of two sets of indicators. One he calls earthy indicators and one he calls ethereal indicators. And the earthy things are the stuff that you can see and feel and taste, the human physical stuff, you know, the fact that you're eating and sleeping well, you're physically healthy, and you're competent and able to engage in your life tasks. Freud called this love and work. And then the more ethereal ones, the things that psychologists tend to think a lot about, are notions of feeling purposeful in your life, feeling a sense of belonging, having some sense of control over your destiny or your fate, having some sense of life satisfaction. This is the notion of the life well lived, not just you're alive, but you're somehow living well. We also know that wellness is not a dichotomy. Here we see a sick child and a well child. We know that wellness exists on a continuum. And it can also be talked about at varying levels. We can talk about the health of a person or the wellness of an individual. We can talk about the health of a community or a congregation. I work with scales, psychological assessment measures that have been developed in order to assess the social climate of a congregation, a school, for example. And then you can just continue to carry this out to the very largest context, which community psychologists are interested in. And here we see an index, I'm not recalling exactly what year this was, but this was put out in order to try to project, it's looking at GDP and in relationship to subjective well-being in a variety of countries and in the world, and surprise, surprise, GDP and, you know, sort of economic indicators are related to people's reported sense of subjective well-being. So you can sort of map, like, the happiness of the world. This is what some people do. So wellness can be, it's on a continuum. It can be thought about at multiple levels. We also need to think about it very developmentally and very dynamically. You wouldn't describe what a thriving baby is like in the same terms that you would describe a thriving older adult, for example. There are similarities and there's distinctions, and this is probably important for us to think about all along the developmental lifespan, even within adulthood. Early career professionals' lives are going to look a lot different than people who have been doing their job for 10 years. And then finally, wellness is contextual. What you need and what you look like as a healthy child in school looks different than what the competencies are that are engaged as healthy, well-functioning on a work site, and they can also be contextualized by people's ability levels. So we know that wellness is a desirable and it has all these features to it. Psychologists, often, many of whom are very action-oriented and often interventionist-focused, the question always becomes, well, can you promote wellness, or what kinds of things erode wellness in individuals? And I just chose a few slides. These are huge. These are all huge literatures. Obviously, you know, if you had Psych 101 and you learned about the monkeys, the wire monkeys and the cloth monkeys, we know that if you give children nurturance and warmth and you let them attach, if you let babies attach to a caregiver and keep that caregiver stable, they're going to do much better than if you deprive them of one individual that they can attach to, warmth and nurturance. And you can carry these kinds of conditions out into other contexts for children. Important context is the school, and you can see vast differences in the stimulation and resources that are available for children in schools. When I was in graduate school in Philadelphia, I did a school visit, a child that I was working with clinically, and it was my first experience of finding out that the kids in the public schools in the poor neighborhoods in Philadelphia had no textbooks. They had no textbooks. I had never encountered anything. I was wondering how you could have school without textbooks. So here are just a list of some of the kinds of threats to wellness that have been identified by community psychologists and other people in developmental psychology and public health, and many, these are very interdisciplinary areas of psychology and other fields, and as well as people have begun to take this knowledge about what erodes wellness and try to work on ways of fostering wellness in individuals and communities in contexts. And while it's possible, these efforts often tend to be complex and multidimensional in nature. People in areas of prevention and promotion tend to focus early on. There's a very important meta-analysis about 10 years ago that showed that you actually can prevent a lot of kinds of problems in young children. It was the first time that we could really support that back in the 80s by Jerlach and Wells. It takes a lot of different pathways and a lot of different means to prevent the kind of problems in child development and in other areas across the lifespan that we're concerned with. This is a very simple example of a model of how community and other kinds of psychologists think about human functioning. And, you know, Freud, every psychologist has sort of a different way of thinking about things. And rather than talking about the id and ego and what your mother did to you, some people think about risk factors and protective factors in relation to both what's happening very close to you or inside you, as well as influences that are much broader, even at a societal level. And here's just an example of a set of risk and protective factors and conceptual factors that influence whether people are well and healthy or whether they're really struggling. And I'm just going to give some examples. You know, don't you, that wonderful events like a marriage or the birth of a child are also very stressful. I remember when I was getting married in graduate school, I took one of those stress checklists. Did you ever take one of those? I was supposed to be dead at the bottom of it. I was getting married, I was doing a degree. So we were talking about what's going on in our lives at the beginning of this. I think we don't want to take a stress checklist right now. But even positive events create stress in our lives because they often mean that you're going through significant transitions, and those things are requiring a lot of psychological and other kinds of energy, don't they? The wrong way. And then it turns out that little things or big things like Chicago traffic or that dripping faucet that you just can't fix or the dog hair on the couch that you can't get up, these daily hassles end up being pretty erosive on people's mental health. It's actually the daily hassles in life that can create a lot more sickness, both physical and mental health, than some of these great big life events that we used to, those used to be the only things that psychologists measured. Now we're really concerned with daily hassles. And people who live in poor environments, even if you disregard, you know, violence or exposure to really serious kinds of stressors, the daily hassles that are involved in being in a low resource kind of a context can just really have tremendous impacts on individual and community health. And then finally, we have the big fat things that everybody would think of immediately, God bless you, things like natural disasters or human-induced disasters. And then what's been coined the vicious spiral, we talk about vicious and virtuous spirals. Vicious spiral would be something like when a person who's maybe not living that much above the poverty line loses a job. That loss of income may mean that they lose their child care, which may mean that it makes it extremely difficult for them to go and look for another job, which means that they lose their housing, which means that they have to move back into an abusive situation because they feel they have no other options, which means they expose their child to more violence and themselves to more violence, and they lose their health care stability. You can see how the loss of one kind of a stressor can have its own direct effects, and then it can cause this vicious cycle of other corrosive impacts. And this is just one of the models that we use to try to look at how some of these things interact. It turns out that it's not just important what's happening to you, what kind of stressor is happening to you, but it turns out it's pretty important how you think about it, and that not everybody thinks about things in the same way. So here we have a guy that is, you know, this has happened to all of you if you live in Chicago, I know. And what's his problem, first of all? What's the stressor? Broken umbrella? Yeah, what's going on, do you think? It's raining, it's blowing winds, yeah. Okay, so what's he trying to do to fix his problem? What does it look like? How's he trying to fix it? Yeah, he's trying to, you know, punch it back into the direction that it's supposed to be in. How often does that work in the wind? Sometimes, 50-50 maybe, okay. So he's taking a pretty logical approach, though. Did he think it works? Okay, so we have the pessimists over here, the optimists, how many people think it works? Okay, that could be our own little study. Okay, well, we don't know. I didn't see the picture of what happened next, but I'm going to show you a different guy who took a different approach to the problem. Here's somebody that thought out of the box, same problem, right? How did he think about it? He doesn't have a purse. That's right, he's got two hands, so he's got opportunity. That's resource opportunity, good. Okay, what did he do that was different? He's going with it. that he's rolling with the stressor, but he's using it in his favor. This is an example of somebody who's appraised the same stressor, has the same stressor, appraised it as stressful, just like the other guy. But this guy, you know, let's imagine that he continues to struggle. He's getting wet. I'm glad he has a hat and coat on. But if he fails, the big question for his help and his dryness will he have another idea? This guy, as long as his arms don't get too tired, he's dry. Okay. So we know that in a world where there are these kinds of stressors, whether they're large ones like disasters, deaths, war, or whether they're the daily hassles that can really erode our physical health, we know that well-being is possible and that it probably is a function of this sort of complex set of ways of appraising things and what we have available to us. Not everybody has the same set of resources, do they? And not everyone has the same way of appraising or the same set of coping resources. But we also know that for some individuals at some points in their lives, they're able to get beyond just not being sick or feeling well. They're able to thrive and they're able to flourish. And one of the kinds of kids and family, I feel really just a sense of so much respect for people who live, and all my work has been in challenged urban American communities, poor communities. And while I was socialized growing up, not having lived in a community like that, I was socialized to believe that in the hood, everything is, you know, broken, and, you know, people and things are all broken, and, you know, people stay away from neighborhoods like that. And on television, it's all about crime, right? But you get into these neighborhoods and you find out that there's a lot of thriving and flourishing that still goes on, that there are these amazing individuals, not that they should, you know, have to experience what they do, but there are people, there's lots of resource and lots of flourishing that still continues. How does that happen? People have studied how children and families are able to be, and what the term that we use in psychology is resilient. And my favorite definition of resilience is Emory Cowan's definition, which is swimming well when all known predictors say you should sink. And there's been a whole field of open up studying children and families who are able to function really well despite large sets of stressors, the kinds of exposure to conditions that should mean that they are not doing well, whether that be academically or socially or physically, or in other social indicators like graduating from high school or getting married and having stable relationships. Okay. So how is human flourishing promoted? We've talked a little bit about that. I'm just going to blast through some of this. Coping turns out to be a very large contributor. How you cope, certain kinds of coping strategies seem to be better suited to certain kinds of stressors than others. Whether a stressor is controllable or not will help determine what kinds of coping strategies are useful. For example, getting a lot of emotional support but not studying for an exam that you can't avoid is probably not the greatest coping strategy. A better coping strategy would be finding a friend to study with you, hold you accountable, figuring out, you know, what information you need, what learning strategies work best for you. And we also, most of the literature in coping has focused on the social forms of coping and a really important role in the multidimensionality of social supports as coping resources for people. And lots of interventions have been built around increasing the positive and effective social support that people have available to them. And there are many, many sources of social support. And one of the things that I try to teach my students to do is to look in situations, whether it's families or schools or neighborhoods, where it looks initially like maybe there aren't very many resources there. Community psychology always sees resources. There are always things there to help free up more capacity in a context. And many times if you can't free up more capacity in a family, you can find a teacher, you can find a mentor. It turns out that a kid in a really, really tough poverty situation only needs one person, really. One person who can take a positive interest in them. There can be a very tangible and measurable effect on that child's life. And then there's a whole area of our discipline that focuses on the measurement of and the understanding the impacts of social support networks. And every year in my community psychology class, I have my students draw their own social support networks and analyze them along these dimensions. And most of them have moved. I teach the second year of our doctoral students this class, and most of them have moved, and so they have this whole social support network in another area of the country, and they're just formulating one here. And we talk about the ways in which density and reciprocity of social support networks are really important, and I think they're probably really important for those of us in this room as well. When we talk about density of social support networks, we're talking about if you drew your own map of the people in your life, they'd all be connected to your circle, or if you're a guy, you get to be the squares. Men are squares and women are circles when we draw these things. I'm not sure why I think she did that. But you also look at the connections between those people, not just their connections with you. So a social network, if your social network, almost everybody knows everybody, then that's a high-density network. And if you've got a network, it sounds like most of us in this room are going to have somewhere in between this low and high density based on Dr. Priest's, this notion of having two very important communities that are often not in conversation with one another. It turns out it's not all bad to have one or the other. They have their distinct advantages and disadvantages. Low-density networks give you a greater diversity of resources available and a greater variety of persons and life experiences, whereas high-density networks, you get a lot of consensus, and it's probably going to be faster. You think about somebody maybe who gets a new cancer diagnosis and all their friends know one another, that network might be able to mobilize this practical supports very, very quickly. And then here we see monkeys grooming one another. I'm sorry, I don't know the species of monkeys here. And it turns out... Okay, I'll take your word for it. Well, of course, this is a really positive thing, monkey grooming. We're not doing a lot of it ourselves as humans, but what happens for people in helping professionals, and I would imagine anybody in a teaching role of any sort, is that I spend most of my day, every day of the week, helping others and focusing on others. It's never about me when I'm at my job, or it's not supposed to be. So whether it's when I'm at the clinic on Mondays taking care of patients, or whether it's when I'm at Wheaton on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, or when I'm at home being a parent to my daughter on Thursday, well, I guess I'm a parent all those days. But the notion of reciprocity and social support networks is really important. It turns out it's not so great to only get help. And it's very, very positive to get help. It's very, very positive to give help. But it's pretty bad to only have that going in one direction all the time in every context for your entire life. And so, that goes both ways. If you're never giving, then you're never receiving. And this can be a challenge if you spend a lot of time focusing on the needs of others. So that raises this whole question that I think is really, really important and thorny and complicated, and that I'm hoping that you will help me with, that we can talk about, is this notion of, okay, well, if we can promote wellness and flourishing, and if it can be eroded, and if people like us in the kinds of fields that we are in and the kinds of disciplines that we represent, we have a lot of things going for us, most of the people in this room. If we had a chance to tell stories, I'm sure we all have our shares of stressors and also resources, and we all got here by God's grace. And I know I carry a lot of people, family, friends, people who have supported me. I never would have gotten my education and support without my parents, my grandparents, my mentors, so many people, and just all the cultural privilege in our society that I stand on, and the history of so many people, for better and for worse. But what about this notion of the stresses and the challenges of being in the social sciences and having so many demands on us, especially as academicians and as someone who's also a practicing professional? How much, what's the role of human flourishing? How much should we be promoting it? How much should we be promoting it in others, or the human flourishing of others, and how much should we be promoting our own human flourishing? Okay. Well, the first part, I think, I feel like I have a testimony about, and that is the notion of promoting human flourishing for others. I think, yes, indeed, there is a role for Christian social scientists and for social scientists to help to promote human flourishing. We've shown scientifically that it can be done, and I think there are ethical and moral imperatives, but I think there are also theological and biblical and faith imperatives as well. And here I'm most influenced by the philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff, formerly a retired of Yale. I don't know if any of you have read his work, but I'm drawing on him here, and he has a new book out actually on justice, a very important work. And I've really simplified his argument, but he's essentially, and I've written about this in psychology, the notion of the importance of doing justice. And his simple but brilliant argument really flows from God loving justice, God doing justice, and then God enjoining us to do the same. And he emphasizes the notion of this justice doing being not just a part of what we are commanded to do, but it's actually a reflection of God's image in us. And so as a Christian scholar, and I did a study soon after I got to Wheaton, as I said, I had been at a secular university, and I had known a couple of Christian psychologists, but I learned psychology in the discipline. And when I got to Wheaton, I found out that there are two Christian journals in psychology. I don't know if you're familiar with them, the Journal of Psychology and Christianity and the Journal of Psychology and Theology. And I hadn't been aware of them, and I was very excited to start reading them, and I started to read them, and I found out that they didn't write about anything that I did. I couldn't see very much about people of color, I couldn't see very much about poor people, I couldn't see very much about culture, I couldn't see very much about socioeconomic status, I couldn't see very much about people who lived in rural communities or older adults or children, and I didn't know what to make of that. I thought maybe I had missed a third journal, or what. I just wasn't sure what was going on there, and I actually did a content analysis and found out that in public health and epidemiology, we talk about underserved populations or who uses medical or health care services in the U.S., and we talk about underserved populations. And within mental health, there are many underserved populations. All of the people that I'm called to belong in those groups, children and adolescents, older adults, rural residents, people with serious mental illness, people who are poor, people of color. These are all folks who tend to get less service than they deserve in the U.S. mental health system. And so I wrote a paper that tried to take a picture of what our literature looked like in scholarship and really try to raise the question, is this okay with us as Christian scholars? Is it okay that people that God passionately cares for are really, really missing in our scholarship about psychology? What do we think about that? And that was published on literature that's 10 years old. There was very little discussion about it, so I did another one. I don't think this is necessarily a model. Write a paper that not a lot of people talk about and then do another one 10 years later, but I'm getting ready to submit the 10-year follow-up. And we found the exact same percentage of scholarship that was devoted to those seven underserved populations. We even included people with AIDS and HIV because that's considered an underserved population in mental health, and that did not increase our percentage at all. So this is an example from my own work of trying to think very carefully about what we study along the lines of Nicholas Wolterstorff. And here he talks about the notion of shaping the direction in which we turn our inquiry. And so it makes me always think of a photographer. And, you know, someone can take a picture of this room and they can feature Dr. Priest, they could feature this side of the room, they could focus on the beautiful chandelier. There are many, many ways to subjectively frame this objective reality of all of us here in this room. And even the choice itself to take a picture of this room means something about the values of the photographer, and it says something about what they're using their life for. This is something I've taken extremely seriously in my scholarship and try to teach my students to think very carefully about what you're going to do your dissertation about, what you're going to do your research about, and how does that relate to, and I've started out really asking, how does that relate to our admonition to be part of God doing justice in the world? We also have to grapple then and meet in our discipline with the notion of theory-oriented scholarship and praxis-oriented scholarship. This is a big notion. Community psychologists are called, our professional organization is the Society for Research and Action. And you cannot divide those two things. And community psychologists are trying to change the world. They're trying to remove oppression. They're trying to do justice. That can be a pretty scary thing if you don't happen to value what they value, and this is from a very secular perspective. But they are really trying to do justice in marginalized communities, and that sounds to me like a very biblical kind of a concept. And finally, Walterstorff also urges us not just to think about what we study, but how we study it. And I was baptized into the pain and the tragedy and the exploitation of research in graduate school. I didn't know anything about studies like the Tuskegee syphilis study before I was in graduate school. I didn't know how much often very warranted suspicion and fear and concern there are in poor and minority communities about researchers. I went in with my group of colleagues during my graduate study research, and we were immediately rejected by a very powerful group of parents in Philadelphia. You don't go into the Philadelphia public schools easily, or you didn't back when I was in graduate school. And the women, the mothers in those schools were fiercely protective of their children. They were not interested in having their community be further stigmatized. It was the first time I heard people talk about believing there were genocidal plots against their communities, and these were not people with paranoid thought disorders. Finding out that what psychologists do, both as practitioners and as scholars, often feels like dissection to people. It often feels harmful. And the Hippocratic Oath, if you do one thing, you're not supposed to do harm. And this, again, led me to be attracted to the methodologies of community psychology, which are much more collaborative, much less hierarchical. There's lots of interviewing, qualitative approaches, lots of focus groups, but you can use quantitative and qualitative means, but the idea is to take extremely seriously the collaboration with people from the very beginning of understanding what people care about in their communities. Like your example is a beautiful one of showing what you found to be of concern in your own academic community. So to what you study and to how you study it, so that people end up feeling empowered and having capacities supported and built rather than feeling exploited in the research process. And then finally, in terms of thinking about doing scholarship and yes, we can contribute to human thriving, I think the notion, the Hebrew notion of shalom, and Walterstorff uses this too, is an amazing example of flourishing, often tied to both creation and then end times narratives. And it's the notion of being at peace with oneself, with God, with others, and with creation. And the lion lying down with the lamb is a powerful metaphor of that. But Walterstorff pointed out something that I hadn't been aware of, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, is that the notion of shalom includes the idea of delight. It's not just, it's not just the why can't we all get along kind of metaphor, or I'll tolerate you, tolerance, we talk about a lot in public discourse about multiculturalism. This is so radical, and I absolutely get the chills when I think about this. What God seems to be envisioning for us here is not just that we're going to be able to get along across all our differences, but that we are going to find delight in one another. Delight, of course, we can imagine delight in God. Maybe some of you can imagine delight in yourselves, I'm not sure. Delight maybe with your loved ones, and delight with creation, some of us. But think of the most deeply embedded schisms that we have in our society. What God makes possible is the notion of delighting in one another. And that this is really a picture of human flourishing. So, yes, we should, we can, we ought. I'm trying to, in my tiny way, work toward the flourishing of others as a social psychologist, because this is God's mission. This is what he's doing, and I know I want to be a part of that. But what about us? What about our own flourishing? This is me in my first year as a... No, I'm sorry, it's last year. No, this isn't really me. But, you know, maybe you felt this way in your life. The demands and opportunities that exist both in our work lives and in our personal lives. I had a baby the first year. I was doing a postdoc the first year I taught at Wheaton, and then I had a baby at the end of that. And now I have parents who are aging and experiencing significant health problems, and I know most of my colleagues, our poor students, we tell them all the time, all your faculty members are in midlife. So you're just getting, we have grandparents who are parenting grandchildren. We have a lot of demands on us living out this calling as social psychologists and social scientists. And I experience role strain, role conflict a lot of times. Do you stay up one more hour and grade those papers, knowing that you'll be really tired in the morning when you have to take the dog out and get the kid ready for school, or, you know, and then will I not go running if I do that, or I really should call this friend who I know is struggling, and my husband is going away on a trip for a week, so I really should interact with him significantly, and then I could make lunches for tomorrow, though we'd never do that. But just in one evening of your life, you know, or you're sitting at your desk, you know, do I work on this article? I have 11 references to write for students when I get back, and I'm desperately trying to figure out how I'm going to protect time to write and fulfill my obligations, which I'm happy to do for the students, and be ready for my semester to start. So the obvious, you know, concern is, in fields like ours, is, are you going to burn out? And this is a reality, and you're probably familiar with this literature. I have a group of students, we looked particularly at helping professionals. This wouldn't, we didn't specifically look at academicians, we're looking at helping professionals here. And I'm just summarizing a few contributors to burnout, so see if any of this is describing any of us in the room. It turns out there are personal characteristics that can make you vulnerable for burnout. Things like old wounds in the family where you had to be the helper in the family, or greed. I thought that was an interesting one. You're just in it for the money. I'm doubting that that's a big one in this room. And then look at the interesting professional kinds of vulnerabilities that are on there. Having high aspirations can make you vulnerable to burnout. Being new to the field, a lot of burnout occurs in the first few years of these kinds of professions. Not being able to take things not so personally. You know, taking everything personally is a risk factor. Not appreciating that work can be fun. And look at the last one for us in the room. Seeing your work as a sense of calling is a vulnerability for burnout. Probably goes with taking it really seriously, okay? Then, of course, there's aspects of the work itself, and in psychology and clinical psychology, in doing therapy, these are really demanding kinds of jobs, working the kind of jobs that we have. And I like this, remember this Lucy episode with the conveyor belt that just wouldn't slow down? I mean, some jobs are just extremely demanding, sometimes unrealistically demanding, and with the constraints, the constrictions in the economy, a lot of people are finding themselves doing more than one person's job. And feeling underappreciated, feeling that you're not having enough pay, or just the stress in the role itself. And then finally, there are systemic factors that are certainly involved in burnout for individuals. So we have a demanding calling, and we have started to write to one another about this in psychology. What we ought to do, that's a little ant holding those crackers. My student Jessica Pay found that. So one of the things that people tell you, okay, so what should we do so that we don't burn out? And oh, I had to include this. It's just so, I feel that we should have dark organ music at this point. I think he's really overstating it just a tad, but who am I to criticize Freud? So the notion is that, okay, so no other profession where people use tools, do we neglect our tools? If you leave the hammer out in the rain, it's going to get rusty. I just tried to take the rooftop carrier off my car, which was blowing off in the wind on my way home from Pennsylvania. And my Allen wrench was really rusty, and it would not get the lug nuts off, or whatever you call those things. So I had to borrow one that wasn't rusty. Dang, you know, I got to get another one now. It's a beautiful example. We got to take care of your tools. And what if we are our best tools as instructors, as professionals? It makes sense to try to take care of that. And so a lot of people in my discipline say you need to take care of yourself as you take care of others. Okay, so my students and I are really examining this literature, both secular and faith-based, to see, okay, let's examine that, because we belong to a faith, we profess a faith where there's a lot of constructs like dying to self, service, right? How do you square that, okay? Well, first of all, what is self-care? It's what you do and how you feel and how you look at things in order to, you know, nurture or preserve the self. Why take care of it? Well, people write about, well, for the sake of those we serve, because really, especially in psychology, in helping professionals, the relationship with the other person is incredibly important. So you have to be able to engage healthfully in a relationship. And you want to be really careful about avoiding being an impaired psychologist, because you can really harm individuals. Some people say we do it for the sake of ourselves as well, to do things like prevent burnout or create meaning, or because we ourselves are inherently valuable. And a few people write about, well, because it's important to the other people in our lives, like our spouses and our children. And most of the literature about this is how to. There's zillions of recommendations of what to do to take care of yourself, from, you know, thinking about things differently, to making sure you're well organized and efficient, to making sure you get good rest and nutrition, figuring out how to have a life outside of work and getting support and engaging spiritual coping strategies and getting into a healthy organization. My favorite bizarre one is invite someone dangerous to tea. That was someone's suggestion. We can't figure out how that helps you take care of yourself, but that was actually someone's suggestion in both of you guys. Another thing that you hear often, and I'm sorry, I'm afraid that I'm going to, I know I've used this, and I'm sure a lot of us in the room have told ourselves and told us that we just need to keep it all balanced. If we can just go for balance, we'll be okay. Balance the needs of others, balance the needs of ourselves. Sometimes I think of it like this, like, well, I have more than those things that I'm trying to balance. It feels like a lot of things I'm trying to balance. And actually, I just put together a little slide here of some of the context. These are only some of the contexts in my life that I need to balance. And I thought, you know what? I really hate it when people tell me that I just need to get it balanced. Because I really don't think that that's possible, to balance these things. And as I've looked in the scriptures, I'm not sure that I'm seeing anything that's consistent with an American notion of balance as I hear it talked about. I'm really interested in that, though, because I'm not sure that I'm missing that yet. Oops. So where does that leave us? If I don't like the notion of balance and I'm concerned about the notion of self-care, even though I think there's amazing contributions in that literature. Well, that's where I'm hoping that you'll help us. But all I know are the really important questions at this point. First of all, what are the lines between mature Christian self-sacrifice and service and undiscerning self-destruction or self-centeredness? This goes by a lot of different names, you know, codependence or needing to be needed, or that's the messianic complex there. Supposed to be, my discipline is notorious for that. You know, we like to save people, or we like to be the, you know, omniscient professor at the front of the room. And if there are lines between these things, how do we detect them? And then if we can detect them, how on earth do we faithfully choose the mature Christian means of self-sacrificing service? Some other questions that my students and I talk about is, when is it permissible or healthy or mature to prioritize your own needs and concerns in light of the fact that there's all these other needs that go on out there? And this is a daily thing that we grapple with. How can we rightly discern needs from desires? I hear a lot of my students saying, well, I need not to do this assignment because I need to get some rest. Well, not a lot of my students, but I think. And you think, okay, is that a need or is that a desire? How do we know? And then how active ought we to be to meet our own needs versus trusting God to meet them as we serve Him? And I'm just starting to play around with the notion of fidelity. I was a voice vocal performance major in my undergrad, and music is a really important part of my life and my family's life. And rather than the notion of balance, I'm starting to think a lot more about the notion of fidelity. And fidelity comes from the Latin meaning to be being faithful or to trust. It has origins in fealty language or loyalty of servants, pledging. It's the notion of devotion with zeal. It's applied to conjugal faithfulness, and it's also applied in acoustics to talk about the accuracy of, for example, electronic systems now to reproduce or the sound or an image of its input signal. And I think this has a lot to afford us about what it means to live a Christian life as a person of service, as a helping professional, as a social scientist. Fidelity to God and to our covenant with God. And I like this picture of in the old receivers that we used to have when you'd be adjusting the bass and the treble and all of those things. You know how you never, well, you're not supposed to put them all in the middle, are you? If you put them all in the middle, the sound is very muddy. So the notion of balance really doesn't reflect what life, you know, lived with the fidelity is really about. Music can't be captured all at one time, and neither can our lives be captured all at one time. And I think it often has this dynamic, multidimensional, messy, and sort of creative sense. And I also like the notion of fidelity being a referential term, that we're living our lives in reference to God, not in reference to ourselves, which is what I see in so much of the self-care literature. The notion of covenant here is really important, and I think I don't have time to really unpack a lot of this, but I think we can drive ourselves as professionals out of a need to prove our own worth, or because we think we should be excellent, and covenant has law embedded in it as a construct, but it also has the notion of love. It's a voluntary love agreement and commitment that's made. And it's conditional, and it has consequences, which are either blessings or curses. And so the notion of flourishing, because we are, in fact, serving and dying to self, is paradoxical, but it's very biblical. We see in Isaiah 58 that when you live as people of justice, doing justice to orphans and widows and aliens, and having the kind of fast that God requires, which is to do justice, look at the list of what breaks out in the people of God when they do this. I have my students come up with this list every year during class time, and I ask them, raise your hand if you want any of this stuff on the board. And we are all salivating for this kind of thing in our own lives and in the lives of other people. And it turns out that if you do justice, if you spend yourself on behalf of the hungry, is one of the phrases in that passage, isn't it? Okay, if you spend yourself, then you will flourish. It's a paradox. Oops. So, I'm asking myself, I'm asking us, who are you in a covenant with? And what motivates your faithful ongoing participation? And I think one of the things that enables me to live my life as opposed to just struggle through it, or to not feel like that ant carrying the little, whatever they are, cheese crackers, when I have so many demands and so many people to take care of and so many choices, and as I age and have less and less energy, I think the orienting response for me is, I am in a covenant with God. I am in a contract with Wheaton College. And I'm actually in a covenant with them as well. We have a covenant. I have a contract with the Lawndale Christian Health Center, but I am in covenant with God. And grounding myself in what is He doing? What is God's story in creation? And what is my part in it? And what is my story? What is your story? I wish we had time to talk about how did you get here? How did you get into the social sciences? I can't tell you my early story, but this is one of my stories in Exodus 17 that really describes, I use this as my banner for my work as a psychologist. This is what I do. And I'm her, H-U-R. I'm the her character in this. Which I know is a man, but I kind of like that it sounds sort of like a female. And I like that this is a very anonymous person here. So this is the very first battle that the Israelites encounter as they go out toward the Promised Land. And it's that amazing story of the body of Christ being used to accomplish what God is doing. So Moses says to Joshua, choose men, go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I'll stand on top of the hill with a staff of God in my hand. Okay, I totally don't get that, but I don't think we need to. Apparently that was important, okay? So he stands there with the staff. Joshua goes out and leads the fighters. And while Moses held his hand up, Israel prevailed. But he got tired. His hands grew weary. And when his arm dropped with the staff, they started to lose. So what happened? Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, the other on the other side. So Moses' hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. My work as a community and clinical psychologist in the context of poor urban communities, I think of as a battle. There's a lot of beauty there, and there's a battle there. You know, you go into our communities and you see both. You see what Satan is doing, and you see what God is preserving and what God is doing. And my little part of the battle, I believe, as a community psychologist, is to come alongside the people who are laboring in medical, educational, psychological ways of supporting children and families in those communities and help hold up their arms. I add my little social scientist piece to what they're doing. I hope to add value, and I hope to be in community with what those people are doing, to be a part of the battle, not just stand outside as an expert and toss in my knowledge from over in the ivory tower, but to be a part of it, an anonymous part, maybe not always on the front line, but someone who helps to hold up the hands of those who are on the front lines every day and being in community with them. That's my vision of myself as a Christian social scientist. So finally, I try to orient myself again and again to that, and not just in a theoretical way, but okay, what does my calling mean for the opportunities and obligations that are put before me? When I was pleased to receive the invitation to join this group, this track, I had to ask myself, does this fit in with my calling as a social scientist? And I thought, yes, it does, it does. How do our opportunities and obligations reflect that notion of what you are about in God's story, and asking yourself that in every opportunity and choice. Sometimes it's hard to see how, even when we know it's an obligation. And then finally, how do my activities and my choices help me faithfully live out my story? Sometimes it's a struggle for me to feel like it's okay to go to bed. I can't stay up all night like I used to. I went to bed at 1 o'clock last night, and I probably should have stayed up till 3. But I can't do that anymore because my aging body really won't take it, and I'll start to get crabby and cranky with my family, and I maybe would have trailed off in the middle of sentences today, which maybe I've done, and you'll tell me if I have. But if I think about going to bed and getting some sleep as something that helps me to carry out what God has called me to do, that's one way to look at it. Or if I think about it as, you know, because I need to take stewardship of my body, this amazing resource that I've been given, I think that's also another biblical way to think about it. Or it could be just like, because I feel like it, which is not necessarily a reflective and thoughtful Christian approach. And this final metaphor that I'll give is the notion of the race, and I wish we had time to look at all these passages together, but Paul talking about our Christian lives as a race, as a marathon, and training and being focused on the activities that enhance our ability to finish the race. I want to finish the race, folks, and I want all the people that I come in contact with that God has called them to do this stuff that we're in this room to do, I want them to finish well, too. And I think one of the ways that we do that is to think about all our choices and what we're doing. Is that related to the race? First time I went to Kentucky and saw the horse farms and the race horses, I was shocked to learn how little they actually run on the track. They spend very little time running, except in those really big races.
But everything about their lives is oriented around that race, what kind of hay they eat and grass they eat, and whether there's a dog or a goat in the stall with them to keep them calm, and who interacts with them, and how they're groomed. And everything is oriented toward the race, even though only a little bit of it looks like it's training for the race. So maybe going to have, you know, coffee with a friend, taking a bubble bath, you know, maybe those things can be self-centered, or maybe those things can be part of finishing that race and finishing that race strong. You can't always tell just by looking at the surface of the activity. And finally, I certainly don't want to give the impression, so often I think when psychologists talk, it can become a self-project. Here's another self-project for us all. And if we have more time to talk about that covenant, that strange Genesis 15 covenant that I showed a picture of briefly, of God having Abraham sort of walk, kill these beasts and walk between them, these sacrificed beasts. That was an ancient custom that signifies if you break a covenant, you shall be torn to pieces like these animals. And usually it was the servant pledging the covenant with a great lord that walked between the pieces. But if you remember that passage, it's not Abraham who walks the pieces. God appears like a flaming pot of fire, I believe. And the implication there is that we cannot possibly fulfill our covenants with God without him, can we? We are both called to fulfill it, and it is an impossibility for us to do so. And if you look at the history of God's church throughout the Bible, throughout history, it is this impossible paradoxical combination of being called to stuff that we just cannot do. Why should we expect anything differently in our callings as social scientists? Therefore, let us give what we have, be stewards of what we have, be training to finish the race, and let's remember that only God can empower us. Only God can fulfill that in and through us. So, thank you. Thank you.